to this week's episode of the Just Publix at 365 podcast series. I'm your host, Heidi Knobloch, and today I'm going to be talking with Joseph Strauss, Distinguished Professor in the Music Department at the Graduate Center CUNY. We're going to be talking about Professor Strauss's research and theorizing on disability in music. Specifically, we're going to discuss how disability has traditionally been treated by music theorists and why Professor Strauss has decided to take a different approach. So without further ado, let's get to the interview. So I guess the first question I have is really a basic one, which is, you know, why hasn't there been a ton of work, or hadn't there been a ton of work until you, on disability in music?
Well, disability studies itself is a very, very new field. Dating back to, I don't know where the good starting point would be, maybe the publication of a book by Rosemary Garland Thompson in 1997. So the field has not been around very long. And music, for all kinds of reasons, tends to lag behind other disciplines in adopting modes of critical inquiry that focus on meaning, because music, in certain obvious ways, is devoid of explicit linguistic meanings, because it's just a bunch of sounds. And so even when disability studies was getting going, I think people who even had a passing thought that music might be implicated in some way were deterred by music's famously non-representational nature. People would say, well, you know, here's a string quartet. What does the fact that it's in B-flat major have to do with disability? And so I think it took a while to realize that actually, as a cultural product, like any cultural product, it's influenced by potent cultural forces like race, like gender, like class, and like disability.
Yeah, and the standard narrative that I've heard in, you know, music theory has been that the great musicians overcame their disability. And your work really diverges from that narrative. Could you just speak a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, the standard narrative about disability, not just in a musical context, but in any context, is one of overcoming. So typically, cultural products, literature, art of all kinds, tends to follow a narrative trajectory in which disability is extinguished, overcome, remediated. I mean, what Rosemary Garland Thompson refers to as the cultural logic of euthanasia tends to apply in literature and in other narrative forms, whereas disability comes in the form often of a character with a disability, and the narrative trajectory takes the shape of either curing that character or extinguishing them for the narrative to conclude in some satisfactory way. You know, think about, Darth Vader, for example, to take an example. A character whose disability manifests some kind of underlying defect in character, which is often how disability is treated metaphorically, and the narrative concludes with his death. The disability has been, in a sense, overcome or extinguished. Again, the logic of euthanasia, to cure or to kill. And indeed, that seems to have been a common narrative shape in music as well. That music also is about disabling musical situations, and the musical narrative often also takes the shape of overcoming. What's distinctive about a disability studies perspective on these narratives is that we don't assume any longer that this is sort of the natural progression of things. We don't assume that disability is inherently a defect or a pathology that needs to be cured. Rather, we approach disability as a aspect of naturally occurring human difference in shape, bodily shape, and in bodily functioning, or mental functioning. Not necessarily, the buzzword in the field is difference, not deficit. So instead of thinking about disability as something that needs to be cured or remediated or normalized, rather think about disability as something potentially to be claimed, celebrated as a distinctive and interesting and valuable way of being in the world. So that's the disability studies perspective that I bring to bear on music. And one of the things that you learn to do as a consequence is to look at the kinds of ways in which disability is constructed, the way disability is shaped in different times and in places. And one of the very familiar ways that disability is constructed and shaped is, as you suggested, in terms of narratives of overcoming.
Yeah, and so could you outline for us and maybe even give an example of how certain modes of music making have been enabled by disability?
Okay, I'll give you a couple of examples. Any discussion of disability and music has to mention Beethoven. He stands right at the center of the Western musical canon, and he was deaf. He went deaf progressively over the course of his life and ended his life quite deaf. And his deafness affects his music in lots of different ways. During his lifetime, the understanding was that it was purely a defect. That is, the deafness was a defect of his body, and it manifested itself in music, in the production of defective music. It particularly affects Beethoven's late music, which was considered at the time to be not only obscure, but poor, badly constructed. The feeling was, poor Beethoven, what do you expect? He's deaf, and this is the best he can do, and the music isn't very good, too bad. And then later on, a different narrative around the disability tends to form, and talking now in the middle of the 19th century with Wagner. And Wagner looks at Beethoven's deafness and thinks, well, the deafness marks the music, but not as a defect, but as a mark of its transcendence. That is, lucky Beethoven, his deafness isolated him from normal daily life and permitted him to achieve this kind of transcendent vision. That's another common way in which disability is narrated. I mean, I would say that Beethoven's disability enabled him to write the music that he did, not in a defective way and not in a transcendent way, but in some rather particular ways. He's able, given the world in which he operated, he's able to do certain kinds of things compositionally that are made possible by his deafness. So again, I don't want to mystify these things as transcendent. I certainly don't want to pathologize them as defects, but Beethoven's music is marked by his deafness. Another way in which disability comes into music, and there are so many, is when you talk about performers with disabilities and the ways in which their particular way of making music is shaped by, or to use your expression, enabled by their disability. So, for example, there's a well-known British-Scottish percussionist named Evelyn Glennie, who's deaf. I guess I'm talking also again about deafness. And she argues quite strongly and persuasively that her way of approaching her instrument, her way of making music, is enabled by her deafness. She doesn't feel it's defective. She feels that she is making her music in a distinctive way because of her deafness, not in spite of her deafness, not because she's overcome her deafness, but through and with and on account of her deafness.
Yeah, and you also, you draw some parallels, and you just did a little bit just now, and I would like to just push you a little bit more on it. You draw some parallels between music performance and performing disability. Could you talk about that briefly?
Sure. I mean, it's one of the truisms, again, in disability studies, that disability is not so much what you are, but rather it's something you do. That is not necessarily an inherent quality of your, inherent in your body. The disability doesn't reside inside of you. Rather, disability is something that emerges in negotiation with the ambient culture. In short, disability is performed. It's something that you do to make your disability manifest. It's particularly true in the case of disabilities that would otherwise be invisible. But even with disabilities that are perfectly visible, the disabled person has a certain latitude in shaping the way in which the disability is presented publicly. And the shorthand term for that is performing disability. So to give an example, in autism, you know, autism is invisible. You look at someone, you can't tell by looking at them they're autistic. In order to understand them as autistic, they have to perform their disability in certain ways, hand flapping, certain, you know, kinds of verbal gestures that are associated with autism are ways of manifesting the autism. And that's true with lots of disabilities. They have to be performed in some way. And of course, music is inherently a performance art. You get up on stage and people stare at you and you do this remarkable thing that most people can't do. And these two kinds of performances merge and intersect in interesting ways when the performer in question has a conspicuous or visible disability. And there's lots and lots of performers like that. And their disability very often affects the way in which their music making is perceived, and it very often affects the way in which their music is made in the first place. I already referred to Evelyn Glennie. There are lots and lots of of performers with disabilities. There's a whole ancient tradition of organists and keyboard players who are blind, going back to the Middle Ages, in fact. There's a very, very well-known one-armed pianist named Paul Wittgenstein, Ludwig's brother, who lost his arm in World War I and was wealthy enough to commission a lot of famous composers to write pieces for him for left hand alone. And so there's an example of how the disability is performed. His right sleeve is pinned to his shirt as he plays, and his right side faces the audience. And he plays with his left hand. So he's simultaneously performing music and performing his disability, and the two kinds of performances are intimately intertwined.
Could you just talk about how you came to start doing this type of disability studies in your work?
Sure. I came to it, as a lot of people do, through personal and familial experience. That's not the only way into this field. There's lots, as any legitimate academic field, you don't have to be an actual identity card-carrying member of the tribe to participate in the field. Nonetheless, that was kind of my way into it, which is my older son, who's now age 22, is autistic. I had given a colloquium at Penn State on Stravinsky or some other musical topic. I was riding back home on the train, and I found myself in conversation with a professor of English at Penn State, and who saw I was reading a book about autism, which I frequently did at that time. And she asked me if I was interested in disability studies, and I said, "What's that?" Because I had no idea. This was about 10, 12 years ago, and the field was not on my radar. It certainly wasn't on most people's radar. And she suggested a few things to read. And my initial reaction was, how can there be a field here? I mean, a disability is a medical thing. It's a biological thing. It's a physical thing. There's no cultural thing. I mean, either you have tuberculosis or you don't. You have cancer or you don't. You're deaf or you're not deaf. I mean, my first reaction was, this is silly. There's no field here. And I gradually became aware, doing some reading, that, it's like gender. In other words, it's something that's, on the one hand, it seems self-evident what its meaning is. You know, there are boys over here, and then there are girls over there, and, you know, why are we even having a conversation? But then it turns out, of course, when you start thinking about it, gender is a much, much richer, more complicated subject than that, and the same thing turns out to be true of disability as well. So my first resistance was one that I think a lot of people have, which is they think they know what disability is. They think they know that what disability is, that it's a medical pathology, it's a medical problem, it's your private sorrow, and it's between you and your doctor. And so the first hurdle to overcome in presenting and talking about this field is just to understand that, well, yeah, there may be a medical component, no one denies that, but there's also a pretty significant cultural and social component as well. And then my second resistance was, when I'd become convinced of that first thing that I've just said, was, what does music have to do with this? And at first I thought, again, well, music is non-representational. I mean, you know, in Charles Dickens, you know, there's Tiny Tim with his crutch, and so there's obvious ways of starting to talk about representation of disability in literature. How do you do it in music? And at first I was kind of stymied, and then it just became evident, my God, there's a zillion ways. There are composers with disabilities and performers with disabilities. There are listeners with disabilities, and then there are kinds of stories that music itself tells about disability. And so it turned out that the floodgates then opened up, and there are all kinds of fabulous disability-related musical projects. And because the field is so young, the field of disabilities is so young, disability studies is so young, and because the musical aspect has been undertaken only so recently, there are lots and lots of really, really great projects. So just for one example, there's never been a good disability studies discussion of Porgy and Bess. You know, central canonical work of American opera, the protagonist has a disability, and mostly it's talked about from a race point of view, which, great, I mean, that's obviously pretty important too, but the disability angle has not been written about much. So there's one great project, and there are tons more.
So now I want to ask you what might be an obvious question, but why is it important to study disability in music?
It's important to study disability music because, well, first of all, it's incredibly pervasive as a topic. previously mostly unrecognized, but it turns out that everywhere you turn, it's there. And if you want to understand music in the culturally richest possible way, you're needlessly impoverishing yourself if you ignore disability. And a second reason, and this brings the story up to the present in a certain way, lots and lots of people who are engaged with music in one way or another, as composers, as players, as listeners, themselves are dealing with disabilities of one kind or another. And to make public and make explicit the link between disability and music, for them, is often very liberating and a very significant thing. So instead of thinking, well, their music is over here on one side and their disability is over there on the other side, to imagine that these two things actually might be brought into some kind of productive relationship to each other, that can have a very significant impact on people and people's lives. One of the experiences I've had in doing this work and presenting this work is that almost every time I give a lecture on this topic, one or more people in the audience come up to me afterward and talk in rather intimate terms about their relationship to disability and their relationship to music and the ways in which those two things are intertwined. So this resonated deeply with lots of people and I think has the power to significantly transform not only people's musical lives, but their lives.
So you've done a lot of really great scholarship on this, and in an ideal world, how would you like people to use your scholarship?
Well, that's a challenging question. I'd like people to use my scholarship in two ways. One is to think about additional ways in which the very rich and important world of music intersects with disability in all kinds of ways. As I mentioned, there are so many fascinating, important projects that can tell us so much about the history and the meaning of music. And at the same time, I want to be able to say to a reading audience that's mostly interested in music, you know, there's a whole new civil rights movement out there that maybe you've been in the practice room too long to have taken notice of, but the world is changing in important ways. There's a disability rights movement, there's a disability studies field, and you should know about it whether or not you identify yourself as someone with a disability.
How has your scholarship changed the outlook or your outlook on disability?
Okay, well, that's sort of the other side of the earlier coin. So we talked previously about how my life experiences led to an interest in this particular kind of scholarship. And now you're asking sort of the opposite question, which is how does the scholarship then sort of reflect back and loop back and impact one's life? Well, I mean, first of all, you have to understand disability is not just a property of a small handful of isolated people. Lots and lots and lots of people, it's a huge minority group if you want to think about it that way, are people with disabilities. So the whole topic is a highly, highly significant one. Everybody is eventually going to be disabled if they live long enough. Pretty much everybody has close relationships, familial or friendly relationships with people who identify as being disabled in one way or another. So it's not just an esoteric interest for a small handful, but rather it's something that affects really pretty much everybody in one way or another. And just as you don't have to be African American for race to play a role in your life, and you don't have to be a woman for gender to play a role in your life, disability in the same way is for everybody. Everybody has a relationship to disability that's significant. In my own personal experience, I've had the very interesting effect of my thinking about disability transforming in fundamental ways my relationship with my son. At the time that I described earlier when I was riding on the train and reading about disability, I was thinking very much of autism, rather. I was thinking very much of autism as a medical problem requiring remediation, and my main interest was in finding therapies that would help to normalize and potentially cure my son. And so I thought about him in a way as a kind of medical patient, and I thought about myself in a sense as a kind of therapist, that I was going to be like a medical professional. I was going to work with him as a patient. And it was not a very pleasant way to think about your own child. And one of the things that this disability studies perspective has changed for me is thinking about autism not as a pathology that requires a cure, but rather as a distinctive way of being in the world, a kind of worldview, a difference, not a deficit, as I said earlier. And that has enabled me to appreciate so many things about my son. So when he was really little, before he was diagnosed, I thought the things he did were charming. And then at a certain point, I was taught that the things he did weren't charming. They, in fact, were symptoms of a serious neurological illness. And now, I think they're charming again. And I think he's quite lovely again. And so in some ways, my new thinking about disability has gotten me back to a way of thinking and feeling about him that for a long time was shadowed by the tendency of the medical model to pathologize disability.
Thank you so much. This is great.
You're very welcome. Thanks for talking with me.
Well, that was this week's episode of the Just Publics at 365 podcast series. Join us next week for a conversation with Michelle Fine and Michael Fabricant on charter schools and the corporate makeover of public education. Have a great week. Just Publics at 365 is a project of the Graduate Center CUNY, located at 365 Fifth Avenue, where you will find the life of the mind in the heart of the city. Just Publics at 365 is funded by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.